Why one street in one neighborhood was targeted is unknown, but it was hit with anti-Semitic flyers. The street is just outside the town of Bel Air. That's where Alex Dimitrik picks up the story.
Wednesday morning, Banavie Terrace East in Harford County woke up to what looked like circulars.
They were found on the ground by the driveway at the entrance of the driveway next to the mailbox.
They were weighted down with three small white rocks inside a plastic sleeve. Dan Taylor still had the one found in his yard. On one side, anti-police and anti-government rhetoric. On the other, anti-Semitic messages, slurs, and swastikas.
I don't see the point in it, you know. I don't know what anybody expects to gain from something like that.
Whoever did it did not leave a name, but the website Daily Stormer was prominent. According to the Southern Law Poverty Center, which tracks hate groups, the Daily Stormer is the top hate website in America. Right now, this is being called a hate incident. To become a hate crime, a specific victim must be identified.
Right now, we don't have any particular victim of a crime at this time, so if we're able to figure out who had done it, then we're going to have discussions with the state's attorney's office to try to figure out if there's any charges that could be applied.
That doesn't mean people aren't disturbed by the flyers.
They said I took mine to church just to show them what was going on because I was horrified at the thought that any religion is bad.
Why this one street was targeted is unknown. Alex Dimitrik, WJZ Eyewitness News.
Anyone with information that might help guide police to the person behind the flyers is urged to call the Harford County Sheriff's Office.
Why not introduce?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I just hoping that we could get a yes or no answer on one of these questions involving Russia. Can you say whether you are aware that anyone who advised your campaign had contacts with Russia during the course of the election?
Well, I told you General Flynn obviously was dealing, so that's one person, but he was dealing as he should have been.
During the election?
No, nobody that I know of. Nobody.
So you're not aware of any contacts during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse. I have nothing to do with Russia. Haven't made a phone call to Russia in years. Don't speak to people from Russia. Not that I wouldn't. I just have nobody to speak to. I spoke to Putin twice. He called me on the election. I told you this. And he called me on the inauguration a few days ago. We had a very good talk, especially the second one, lasted for a pretty long period of time. I'm sure you probably get it because it was classified, so I'm sure everybody in this room perhaps has it. But we had a very, very good talk. I have nothing to do with Russia. To the best of my knowledge, no person that I deal with does. Now, Manafort has totally denied it. He denied it. Now, people knew that he was a consultant over in that part of the world for a while, but not for Russia. I think he represented Ukraine or people having to do with Ukraine or people that, whoever. But people knew that. Everybody knew that.
But in his capacity as your campaign manager, was he in touch with Russian officials during the election?
You know what? He said no. I can only tell you what he... Now, he was replaced long before the election. You know that, right? He was replaced long before the election. When all of this stuff started coming out, it came out during the election. But Paul Manafort, who's a good man also, by the way, Paul Manafort was replaced long before the election took place. He was only there for a short period of time. How much longer should we stay here, folks?
Are you coming to the train, led by a man who wants to break the chains? Establishment is terrified, they can't control his reign. Let's meet this year on the Trump train. Are you come into the train, where brave men called out for a wall built by crane. Media is terrified, they can't control his reign. Let's meet this year on the Trump train. Are you coming to the train, where brave men called out the fools who lead in vain? Lobbyists are terrified, they can't control our reign. Let's meet this year on the Trump train. Are you coming to the train? Wear a hat of hope, side by side with me. Make America great again, break the chains. Let's meet this year on the Trump train.
And we are going to be respected by the world again and not laughed at like we're all a bunch of stupid people being led by incompetent politicians. It's not going to go on any longer.
Are you coming to your train to take our great country back again? Join the revolution, break the chains, let's meet this year on a Trump train.
We're going to win at the borders. We're going to win, and we're going to keep winning. And we are going to make America great again, greater than ever before. Greater than ever before.
Welcome to the Crypto Report.
Okay, welcome to the Crypto Report. Right off the bat, we need to explain a couple things why the show is different this week, don't we, Ken?
Yes.
we did a great first half with our guest, Zeiger. Go ahead and say hello, Zeiger. We're not going to have any preliminaries tonight, so just
all right,
come
hello,
right
guys.
On in.
Hello, guys. This is Zeiger, and I'm happy to be here, though it was a trying first hour.
Yeah, it was. We did about an hour and a half. And of course, this is Zeiger, who is my comrade over at The Daily Stormer, one of my fellow writers there, and he's the host of the absolutely fantastic Hammercast, one of the best, if not the best, out there. It's a place where you can really learn a lot about rhetoric and activism and debating from our point of view. And so I always say that everyone should be listening to Hammercast. There's definitely something there for everybody. But we did a first half. This is normally a three-hour show, so we did an hour and a half. And the program that we used to record it with ditched one of the audio streams. So, like, I think my stuff was gone and Zeiger's stuff was unintelligible. So we're trying recording it another way, but it's late at night and I don't want to put the show off another day or two or anything like that. So we're going to just do a shorter version of the show. We're going to talk about Trump's awesome press conference yesterday. And we're going to talk a little bit about this whole PewDiePie, Disney, Wall Street Journal, YouTube thing. And we'll probably touch on a few other things as well. And we're going to have a really great Q&A section. I've done these before for Hidden Mysteries Radio, and I wanted to make sure and get the best questions possible. So I went to the greatest group of people you could ever ask for questions from, and that is the members of the Daily Stormer BBS. So we'll be getting to that later. We'll have the news. We're not going to have Lawrence's minutes from the death camp this week because apparently he is still on his submarine to Argentina to try to escape the Jewish persecution. And as soon as he arrives at his new bunker, we'll have minutes, most likely next week. We're all hoping, we're crossing our fingers because the minutes are awesome. But anyway, so yeah, let's just start talking about that, Ken. What did you think of the press conference yesterday?
It was pretty good. Everybody was like jaw-jacking about it and just going crazy all over all the voice chats that I monitor, right? And I'm working, so I can't listen to it. So I had to listen to it on the way home. And it was good and long. Everybody's going to hate me for saying this. Like, it was nice to see him poke back a little bit, but like, I don't know. They were making it out to be like, you know, Trump just absolutely, he just smashed him. And I listened to it, and it's more like, sit down. Stop being a goofball. Come on. It was like a father chiding like errant children.
Well, that is smashing them for them. I mean, who else has ever even pushed back at the press, really? You would always get politicians from either side whenever they'd get in trouble and the media would cover them in a way they didn't like. They'd make overtures about the media being biased or whatever. But Trump is the first one who's just come flat. And it's not just yesterday that he started doing it, but yesterday was a really great example of it. But Trump's the first one who elected politician in my memory, who just comes out and flat out says the press lies. They are lying and they're colluding with people who are committing criminal acts, and the press itself is committing criminal acts. It was a really great press conference, in my opinion. Why don't you weigh in, Zeiger?
Yeah, I mean, probably the most important thing that was said, and probably the biggest attack on the media, was when people kept asking him about Flynn, basically because there was this all these articles released that Flynn did something wrong. But when they asked Trump about it, he was like, well, no, he didn't do anything wrong. He was just doing his job, and he's a good man and all of that. I fired him because I didn't like the way that he said that he hadn't said the right thing to Pence, and he didn't give all the information, and he just couldn't tolerate that, so he fired him for that reason. But yeah. Then he, immediately after that, he said, but the real story is that there's somebody giving classified information to the press, and you people are actually disseminating this classified information. So there's a lot of very important things going on now. First is that, of course, there's people in the Trump administration that are leaking classified information, which obviously is criminal. And he really emphasized that it's a criminal act. And he mentioned that, the reason why he's got these criminals leaking information is because he doesn't have his own team in, because the Democrats are delaying and they're really undermining his administration. So that's one important thing that he said. But the other important thing that wasn't really said, well, he did say it, but he said that, you know, you people, the press, you're not supposed to be reporting that. It's also both immoral and illegal to be in possession of this classified information. So my kind of speculation is that this may eventually result in a crackdown on the press because they're engaged in illegal activities by like disseminating all this classified information. So I think it's looking good on that front. And his general attacks on the press are so important because, you know, the Jewish control of the media, like we talk about it very often, but it is like, according to William Pierce, who I've listened to a lot, he was always harping on it that the most important thing was the Jewish control of the news and entertainment media. He was always talking about that because in many ways it's the angular stone of Jewish power. That's what they use to control the minds and the narrative of the people. So if Trump, by his actions and his attacks and his policies, can help further undermine that Jewish control of the media, just that is worth it. I mean, that was worth having Trump as a president just for that. So it's a big white bill.
I don't mean to LARP too hard on this, but can you imagine if he quietly figured out who exactly was doing the leaking and then just quietly prosecuted them, and then the press got wind of it, and like the people in collusion, like, oh, okay, you received classified documents so and so at such and such news organization and you leaked them, you're both going to jail.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. And the hypothetical that he posed when he asked that is it's really got to go over in a very strong way with, you know, Joe America out there, the silent majority, when he said, okay, you know, I all this equipment, phone equipment we've got and all this great security we've got and everything, and I think I'm talking on a secure line, and the next thing I know, my calls with the British prime minister is out there, my calls with the, and whoever else it was, that, you know, there were the Australian prime minister. That's who it was. That call gets released. And he said, so are you going to release when I'm on a private call and we're talking about what we're going to do about North Korea? Are you going to post that too? You know, and people really have to wonder about this stuff because, you know, a thing is either classified or it's not. And we've seen the degradation of the respect that both that the media has engendered in the public about classified information. Because of all the classified stuff that Hillary let out. And it's like these people's political ideologies are not, they're not even really political ideologies when you're talking about the new left today. These people's opinions and their feelings and who they want to win a particular election and all are more important to them than the security of the country, apparently. And yeah, that we're, if they're not going to respect it out of a sense of patriotism, then they need to respect it out of a fear of prison or the gallows.
Well, did you notice how quickly the press tried to they're not stupid, these Jews with their high verbal IQs. They act foolishly, but they are not. They're sublimely clever. And did you notice how quickly they turned that into, Mr. Trump, you don't like the leaks when it comes, you know, on you. But what about Hillary Clinton? And Trump had correctly nipped that one right in the bud when he said there is a difference between something that is legally classified material and John Podesta's emails, like about work office stuff getting released. These are not even on the same level.
Yeah. Yeah. His exact words were John Podesta saying terrible things about his boss. That's what it was. I mean.
And that was a genius turn of phrase, too, because it clearly defined the difference between this was workplace stuff and this is government classified stuff. He drew a hard line right between them.
Oh, yeah.
Threatening the national security of the United States. So it's a completely different class of thing. What I was very sensitive to during the whole presentation was all the little dog whistles he sent, or as we call them, frog whistles. Because while he was, you know, during a lot of time, he was very generic. He was saying like, oh, the media, you're such liars, you're fake news. And he was talking about CNN. Look, CNN is full of hate. And you know, there's a lot of people waiting in line who have higher ratings than you. So you only get one question, stuff like that. But that was very general.
But oh, dude, that noticed, was such a dig.
It was great. I love that stuff. But if you listen to when he was specific and naming specific people, he was always naming Jews. He was talking about Chuck Schumer, about Jeff Zucker, about people like that. So that was very interesting. And, you know, maybe that's just because all the people in the media are Jews, but he didn't need to name any names. But when he did, it was Jews. So.
Oh, yeah. And he wasn't shy about it either, because he was like, maybe your ratings would go up if you actually, you know, just try telling the truth. Just try telling the truth. See if your ratings go up. I don't know. It might help you if you stop lying to everybody all the time. And wait a minute. Doesn't the media have a lower approval rating than Congress? Why should I trust anything you say?
Yeah. And he also compared, I believe he gave, if he didn't, then it was just something he missed. But there have been a lot of polls coming out over the last few days over how much people trust the Trump administration versus how much they trust the media. And they trust the Trump administration to be truthful at a far higher rate than they trust the mainstream media.
Oh, yeah. And it's not surprising. Well, he did say, like, the first thing he said when he started the whole press conference was he talked about his approval ratings. And he says, we've got a new poll saying, the Rasmussen poll, that we have a 55% approval rating. And like that's very interesting, because it either means that like the people who didn't vote for him are now liking him, so meaning that he's really going in the right direction, and even, you know, his enemies are being turned because his results and his actions are so good. But it could also mean that like it was a hoax, that he only got 44% of the vote, and that, you know, those are two different possible things. But just the 55% approval rating is very impressive, and it's, you know, it's encouraging.
Well, there's I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say it's probably a fusion of the two, because, you know, as bad as and crazy as the left and the cucks behaved during the election cycle, it just it went into full supercharge mode the minute that it was announced that Trump was president. We've seen all these eruption of violent looting, rioting, black bloc, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, La Raza, all of them have been out there ripping, tearing, and destroying at an unbelievable rate. And we've seen the entire media just, I mean, it's 24 hours a day. Trump is literally Hitler. Trump wants to eat your children, you know. And so a lot of these people who, you know, they may not have liked Trump's tone, or they may not have liked some of the mean things that he said about, you know, Rosie O'Donnell or Megyn Kelly or something like that. They're looking now and they're thinking, yeah, you know, he was right all along. Look at these people who are opposed to him. And, you know, when you walk around among just normal Americans and you point out the things that these people are doing and the things that they're saying, you don't have to prod them too hard before they agree with you that, yeah, maybe we should just find some kind of an organized way to put all these people in camps and gas them in fake shower rooms.
Well, think about what Trump has been doing for months now, where he's been saying, I'm going to take my message directly to the people. And he said it again in this press conference. And when he prefaces it with 55%, if you voted for Trump, you are very used to poll numbers that are announced being far lower than actual support. So he's probably, if I always believe that Trump, you know, he works on multiple dimensions and multiple levels of efficiency, right? And when I heard that, I took that to mean, you know, the polls are always low, so the support is probably higher. But even if it's not much higher, it's okay to still feel like jazzed on Trump, because most of the country agrees with you. We'll just have to shut down their lying mouths over the next hour.
Indeed. And you know, things are really accelerating. I mean, you were talking about, you know, all these Antifa were getting agitated and burn this shit down.
Yeah.
Well, now you've got the ex-president who's getting in on it. I mean, just a few days ago, we got the news that Obama was building in like a fortress just a few blocks away from the White House. And he's got like millions of dollars in funding that he's going to pour into various organizations to undermine Trump. And basically, he's gonna, what they were actually calling it was, he has a shadow White House now. So he president now, but the dark president. He's gonna try to pull strings from the shadow, and this is complete.
It's unconscionable.
Complete treason. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's unconscionable. It's a complete departure from how presidents have behaved since Washington stepped down and said no, two terms is enough. And I swear to you that if Trump isn't careful, he's going to have to watch out where, like, Obama is going to be treated like a president in exile or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
yeah. It would surprise me.
The thing is, there needs to be a lot more light shed on this thing that Obama's doing, because for one thing, this is all being funded by an organization that is probably still has money left over from his presidential campaigns. This is Organizing for America is the flagship organization behind this thing. And that's what he turned his the Obama 08 campaign organization into the minute he was elected, was Organizing for America. And it was considered a first at the time. And, you know, it was derided by lots of these liberty activists and stuff that, hey, man, you know, this isn't right. This president shouldn't be maintaining this organization, and these funds shouldn't be going to the stuff they're going to. And all like this, this shouldn't be a perpetual campaign, which is what it basically is. And you're absolutely right. Like presidents who wanted to stay active in political type endeavors have traditionally done like Jimmy Carter, where they go and do some type of humanitarian endeavor. Like, you know, Jimmy Carter was the face of what Habitat for Humanity Forever, you know, the people that build the tiny little houses for homeless people.
Yeah.
And he would go around with international human rights organizations to other countries to, which it was kind of ridiculous that the way he did it, but he would go around to other countries and certify whether their elections were open and free and all that. And then you had the other guys who would be like W. You know, when W left office, they said, okay, well, what are you going to do now that you're not president? Are you going to be take a job as a commentator on Fox or something? He said, oh, no, you know, I've been president for 8 years. I'm just going to try to disappear from the political scene for a while. He said the presidency is the hardest job in the world. That guy doesn't need me critiquing him all the time. I mean, good luck to him, right? And Obama has just basically rejected both of those templates, and he is going to be a community organizer until he dies, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that the plan, the Jewish plan or the Soros plan, I don't know, but the plan seems to be to, you know, organize all these blacks and maybe some Antifa to undermine Trump and put Obama as their leader. And they kind of touched on that during the press conference. At the very end, some black woman, I don't remember, from NBC, I think, she asked him about if he was going to work with the Congressional Black Caucus to, you know, help with the inner cities. And he replied that he wanted to do it, but that the Congressional Black Caucus, I don't remember the name of the guy in particular, but the guy wanted to meet him, but then he was advised not to. And Trump said, well, I think it must be someone like Chuck Schumer who advised them not to do it because it was politically non-viable or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, he said so, Chuck Schumer or some other lightweight.
Yeah. You know what this all strikes me as? This strikes me as another FDR, where every other American president had the common grace to not obey, but to observe the tradition where you're done after two terms, and FDR said, make me. And every other president up to this point has had the common grace to drop out of politics when their presidency is done. And then Obama, I swear, is going to force us to pass a law or something because he's going to say, make me.
Yeah. I can't remember which one it is. I can't remember which one it is, but I think we had one president who was appointed to be a Supreme Court justice after his tenure as president was over. But that
That was the fat guy. What was his name? The really fat one, Warren something.
Harding.
Thank you. It was Harding. Yeah. No.
Well, but yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, and with FDR, he was already, by the time he did his third term, he was actually very unpopular, and he used World War II as a fear weapon to keep getting himself elected. His last two elections, his campaign slogan was, we don't dare change horses in midstream, or, you know, something to that effect. And it was like, oh my God, we're in the middle of this huge war. We can't possibly vote out FDR. And, you know, he wanted to be president for life, and he was. He died in office. And that's another case of, you know, this is one of those, he was one of those presidents like Obama that the press, just the Jewish press, just loved him and would cover up anything. People didn't even know that the man was unfit physically, his physical health. He was unfit to be president before he ever took the first oath of office. Until long after he died, everybody thought Roosevelt was perfectly healthy. They had no idea that he was basically bound to a wheelchair and having to go out to Dripping Springs every week and have all these therapies and all this other stuff just to try to keep going. Yeah. And they did the same thing with Obama. And, you know, if Trump has a little allergies or a little head cold and he sniffles a little bit, the press starts screaming about Trump is on cocaine, it appears. And, you know, he's sniffing. I mean, they actually alleged that during the campaign after the second debate because he had a sinus, allergies or whatever. And he pointed that out during the press conference. He asked them, you know, okay, look, why didn't Hillary, when she received, when you, the mainstream media, gave her the questions to the CNN debate, why didn't she turn that in and say, look, I've been given these questions and it's wrong? He said, if I'd been given questions, you would be calling for the reinstatement of the death penalty. You'd put me in the electric chair.
Yeah, he did a lot of that the whole way through, where he was kind of just on the one hand, I was thinking, I don't want to hear the campaign rehashed. It was ugly enough and it was long enough. And on the other hand, I think maybe Trump needs to just constantly remind people of the same points over and over again. How many times do I have to tell you?
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Ken, was that actually Howard Taft that was the Supreme Court justice?
You know what? It was Howard Taft. Thank you. That was okay. Driving me nuts. And I don't want to drive like the listeners crazy with an incorrect statement.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's we talk live and I always tell people I'm wrong all the time, but I'll never lie to you.
Yeah. Speaking of being wrong, do you remember when Trump was saying straight up, if I make a mistake and I screw up and it's honestly bad, I'm not going to fault you for it, because they were like, oh, well, you just only want us to tell the nice stories. He's like, no, I want you to tell the truth. If I screw up, then it's okay to report on how I screwed up, but you need to do it honestly. You can't just lie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some of these lies have been so horrible. I mean, like he's bringing in new jobs, or he's getting a company to bring their factories back to the United States, and the media are like complaining about that. They're going like, "Oh, this is against the principles of free trade and free enterprise. We can't accept this." I mean, it's insane.
AP did that today. We're like, oh, he's going to militarize the National Guard to round up illegals. And the National Guard people are like, really? Nobody told us. You think he'd tell us?
Yeah. And it's not even the distortion of news like that that's even the worst. I mean, look at Pissgate. Look at the stuff that CNN was amplifying for BuzzFeed. And now you've got these like Russian billionaires who were named in the thing that are suing BuzzFeed. The whole thing is a made up bunch of garbage. And CNN knew it was so bad that Anderson Cooper argued with Kellyanne Conway right after the thing came out for about 30 minutes live on CNN. And he kept saying, yeah, but we didn't put a link to that. And she's, oh yeah, you did. I'm looking at your article right now. The link's right there. And then he'd wait about 2 minutes and he'd say, yeah, but we didn't link that. And she'd have to say it again. And I guess the thinking was that this is so horrible that as long as we keep telling them the sky is green, if we say it enough times, they'll think the sky is green.
Yeah. And they're not just doing that to Trump guys. They did that to Bernie Sanders on CNN too, where oops, your feed's mysteriously cut. Sorry there, brah.
Yeah.
Maybe we should at least briefly touch on this whole Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and the ban stuff. It is important.
Yeah.
Like that part was pretty interesting. Like he made some very interesting points, or he talked about that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that blocked his initial Muslim ban has he said that the court is in turmoil and that it has an 80% overturn rate. And that wasn't the first time I heard that. I mean, even before this whole thing, I was already familiar with the Ninth Court of Appeals. And I had always heard of it as kind of a joke court, like as a place where, you know, some weird, ignorant, senile judges are making a bunch of crazy judgments that always get overturned. And I was told never to take that court seriously, basically. So when I heard about this, it was being blocked and delayed by that court. I was like, what the hell is this Mickey Mouse stuff? What's going on here?
Yeah, but those of us on the West Coast of the United States, we come to know that if it gets like a vote on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, we know that whatever's going on is probably going to be overturned.
Yeah.
We just know to be the flip opposite.
Which means that Congress has been derelict in its duty forever, because with an 80% rate of overturning their cases, that means that it's just a derelict court, that they don't bother to consult the law in other cases any more than they do on this one. I mean, you've got a court whose cases are being overturned 80% of the time. It's just a roadblock to justice. There's no two ways about it. You're just wasting tons of taxpayer money, not to mention the money of the people and corporations and states and so forth have to spend on attorneys and all that are litigating these things, and the time that people who may well be innocent or wrongly sentenced or whatever spend in prison waiting for the years for their next appeal to the Supreme Court, if they even get it. I mean, if they're being overturned 8 out of 10 times, they should be impeached and removed.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, if those people have a life tenure, then my theory is that like the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is where all the senile and incompetent judges are like pushed aside and put in their little playpen there, and so that people can kind of ignore them. Well, but I guess they trotted them out for this situation.
Well, that's partially true. Like the old dude from Arizona, the one based in Phoenix that was doing the ruling. I don't know his exact age, but I saw his picture and he's ancient. But like the Jewish broad from San Francisco, she's probably in her 40s, I would say 40s or early 50s. And I can't remember about the guy from Honolulu, but there's we know for a fact that she's a Jew. And a lot of people are saying that the guy from, I believe the guy from Arizona is a Jew as well. His name didn't sound Jewish, but I don't know. I saw some links I didn't follow because it doesn't really matter in as much as, you know, I can't chase down the ethnicity of every single person everywhere, but they're all three acting like Jews. But this whole thing emanates out of, you know, these Northwestern courts, because it was a federal district court in Seattle, I believe, that enacted the initial ban that the appeal was being heard here. And that guy was a Bush appointee. And of course, it was published on Daily Stormer and a lot of other places. He's on video lamenting the horrible treatment the poor Negroes get, and actually saying Black Lives Matter from behind the, you know, from up there behind his black robes and everything. As a judge, he's just saying, okay, it's obvious that the police hate blacks. These police are racist and they're going around looking for blacks to hurt.
No, and it's completely pathetic.
Yeah. The law has nothing to do with any of this. Not in his ruling and not in the Ninth Court of Appeals ruling. Neither one mentioned
the law. It's clear that this entire thing was just a plot to delay. It was a delaying tactic. And the interesting thing that happened is that Trump clearly said, no, I'm not going to play along with this, you know, bureaucratic nonsense. I'm just going to create a new Muslim ban. I'm going to create a new executive order. And you know what? The new one's going to be even stricter. So he did say that in his press conference. He said, you know, it's going to be, we're going to keep all the good things about the previous one, but in many ways, it's going to be better. So my hope and my, you know, my guess for what's going to happen is that he said the new one was being crafted to, you know, go around all of the rulings of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And, you know, go beyond that. So what I think is going to happen is that the new one is going to be even stricter. And the purpose of that is to both punish the people who delayed him and teach his enemies a lesson. Because when you're getting delayed and when people are using cheap tactics against you, you don't want to go along with them. You don't want to play with them. You want to punish them for it. The final result of all this has to be a net loss for the left and for its enemies. They have to learn the hard way that when they mess with Trump, the result is always going to be worse. He's going to find a way to implement an even harsher agenda that's even more triggering to them. So I do think that's what's going to happen, and that's what needs to happen.
Well, you know, and this just occurred to me this second. I mean, we talked about this all before on the Lost episode, and I was going to say about the same thing I said before, but this just occurred to me. The main thrust of the various courts' assertions that the travel ban is unconstitutional is that it is guilty of religious discrimination. It's discriminating on the basis of religion because these are all Muslim countries. Well, then the only thing you would have to do to overcome that barrier would be to add Mexico, India, and Israel to the ban. And that way you would be banning Christians, Hindus, and Jews, as well as Muslims. And hey, that's all constitutional, right?
Yeah. You need to put a white country in there somewhere. So you might as well put Sweden.
Sweden,
you know, just to be on the safe side. So, there's a white country in there, you know, quote unquote.
Yeah, absolutely. Albania. I mean, here's an interesting thing about that. And I haven't heard this get brought up just to show the hypocrisy of this whole thing. You know, they say that because, and this is complete BS, because we know the law says that he can choose any individual or groups of individuals and ban them from coming here without explanation, so long as it's his determination that it's in the interest of national security. But they always claim that the 65 Immigration Act has a clause in it that says you can't discriminate on who comes here based on race, religion, creed, color, national origin, or whatever. Well, if that's the case, then why are black South Africans specifically on our refugee list and white South Africans specifically are not? Where's that court case? Where's that ruling?
Oh, I think we all know the answer to that one.
Yeah, white, well, it's because it's white people.
We don't recognize social constructs as having human dignity, is what I think that means.
Well, and race is always a social construct, but only if you're white.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of the 1965 Immigration Act, I mean, he did speak of that during his campaign. When he made his immigration speech, he referred to the date 1965 once, and then he used like 70 years ago or something. He made at least two references that would talk about, you know, that would imply that he's referring to the 1965 Immigration Act. So I'm pretty sure he's conscious that this law is at the root of the, you know, ethnic problems in America. So I might not put it completely off the table that he intends to repeal that law somehow, or, you know, create a new law that kind of handicaps it somehow. That would be a big thing.
Yeah. Well, and he has said that we needed to take a look at things like birthright citizenship, but also before he ever even decided he was going to run for president, you know, he was one of the keynote speakers at the CPAC conference in 2013. That's the big conservative political action committee. And during that speech, and that it's all over YouTube, you can do a YouTube search for "Trump says we should let white people immigrate here." He said, "And why don't we let Europeans immigrate here anymore? Shouldn't we let Europeans immigrate here?" And so, you know, all that goes against that 65 Immigration Act. That's the, you know, that's that big Jewish double standard that runs through everything. Like I just said about white people being the only race, it's a social construct, is that it's all, you can't discriminate about race or creed or national origin or any of that unless you're doing it against white people. That's right there in the 1965 Immigration Act, or it wouldn't be so hard for white people to immigrate here now.
Well, isn't the state before the 1965 Immigration Act, wasn't the previous law that, you know, determined who could immigrate an explicitly racial law that says that the you know, ratio of ethnic, you know, origins of the citizens can't be altered through immigration? So
yes,
if the 1965 Immigration Act repealed, by default it goes back to basically a white nationalist situation.
Well, that would be hard to say. It would depend on how it got ruled on as to whether we would be going back to 1964 and saying it has to be based on that, or because the way the law was written, the immigration and this was called the National Origins Clause, and in I believe it's either the 24 or the 28 immigration, I believe it's the 1928 Immigration Act, but it's got a National Origins Clause in it that says we will take immigrants based on their national origin in a manner so as not to alter the racial, or what they believe ethnic is the term they use, the ethnic balance of the United States. And if you were to enact that now, then what we would basically be doing is we would have to find out exactly what the ethnic balance here is now and maintain that. But it would be great if we could go back and say, okay, well, we repealed this 65 Immigration Act, so we're going back to 1964, and in 1964, the United States was 90%+ white, so we have to start letting only white people immigrate until we get back to that. That would be awesome.
That would be great, but who knows? Now, that's pretty far off into the future if something that, like that happens.
Yeah. The main thing is if we could, we would be a lot further towards this if we could just do a few common sense things like get rid of the 1965 Immigration Act, deport the illegals, and most importantly, end birthright citizenship. We should be hearing a lot more about that in these discussions because, first of all, birthright citizenship is not a law that we ever passed. They get that from the, I believe it's the 16th Amendment that says that anyone who is born in the United States and is subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a citizen of the United States. And that meant that these recently freed black slaves were now American citizens. And if you went and you polled the people who voted for that amendment, not one of them would tell you, oh yeah, I went and voted for this because what it means is that anybody anywhere on earth can come here and live here forever on our welfare and all that other stuff merely by breaking our immigration laws and sneaking across the border to have a baby here. No, that obviously was not their intent. And, you know, it's activist courts that decided that that's what that meant. And if we could get rid of that birthright citizenship, then that would end the vast majority of these people coming over here thinking they're going to stay forever. It wouldn't end the problem of like Mexican dudes wanting to come over here and mow yards and all that. But it would definitely end this cycle of people getting pregnant and either doing it like the Mexicans where they'll wade across the river when they go into labor and get taken to the nearest hospital and get all their medical stuff paid for, and then they're here forever. And before they even get out of the maternity ward with their baby, they already have a place to stay set up, and they're on all the welfare. You wouldn't have that anymore, and you wouldn't have the Chinese women, you know, going to the travel agencies that openly advertise birthright citizenship tourism, where these Chinese women come here and have their babies here so that their children can be dual citizens.
They come here and they shop citizenships. It's insane.
Yeah. And this is only a recent phenomenon in the history of mankind where, you know, just anybody based on where they happen to be when they're born is a citizen of a nation. Nation has always historically meant your race, your people. And if a nation doesn't mean a specific people like that, it's not a nation. That's why I always say this United States of America, you want to call this a nation? It's a joke. It's an absolute joke. I mean, some guy from, or some woman from Tijuana can get pregnant and like I said, cross the border to have her baby, and we're stuck with her forever. And that baby's supposed to be the same as you and me. It is not. And they don't even think it is. For that forever, they'll call themselves Mexicans.
Yeah. You basically have to remove all of these insane incentives that have been created by the Jews to give all these brown people a reason to come here. Like if you remove birthright citizenship, if you remove affirmative action, if you remove all these social programs that, you know, cultivate parasitism in people, if you remove all of that, then they don't really have any reason to either come here or even stay here for the most part. And that would be a fairly easy thing to remove. I mean, easy is a relative term, obviously, but, you know, it would be a hell of a lot easier than removing all of them death squads. Though I do favor the death squad option, aesthetically speaking.
Yeah. Well, you know, they seem to have forgotten it now that Trudeau is the president or prime minister, whatever he is up there of Canada. Is it prime minister? Is that right?
Yeah, they use prime ministers in Canada.
Yeah. Well, whatever he is, you know, Trudeau's wanting to throw the doors open to all these refugees that the United States is wanting to ban now. But, Canada was one of the first people in the modern era that learned that you can't just extend benefits to the entire world. And the way they learned it was, you know, Canada has had socialized medicine for a long time where if you get hurt or get sick, the state would pay for everything. And the United States had this system where it was a complete capitalist medical system. And so, you know, they would overcharge us for things like drugs because they were the pharmaceutical companies wanted to make up for the slim profit margins in countries that regulated the price of drugs. And so people, just regular middle-class people in the northern U.S. who couldn't afford their drugs here would go up to Canada and go to clinics and stuff and get them for free. And Canada had to pass a law saying we couldn't do that because they couldn't afford it.
Dude, if we didn't have the population that we do, we could have it. If we didn't have Dindus, we could have a Canadian-style healthcare system.
Yeah, probably. I mean, both have their issues. It's mostly about the fact that medical companies and doctors have a kind of monopoly. So even in Canada, where it's socialized, the government is still paying out the ass for all of the medical care, and it's hidden away because people don't foot the bill. Now, it's still cheaper than the United States. I mean, even Canadian government pays cheaper for medicine and medical procedures than, you know, private citizens pay for it in the United States, which is crazy. But, there's still a lot of improvements that could be done. But yeah, not having all these dindus will make a hell of a lot of difference.
Well, yeah, and this is, I've said this, I don't know how many times, but if you have a homogenous nation of white people, you can have just about any system you want other than just straight communism, and it'll work.
Yeah, more or less.
It may not be optimal.
Looted. Yeah, you can still have degeneracy and stuff like that, but it's a lot better, especially when you don't have Jews. Jews are probably the worst, because even if you had black people, if it was, you know, strong white men controlling the government and controlling the system, even black people could be managed. But the Jews are, you know, creating all this insanity and feelings where, oh, you have to take care of these people, otherwise you feel guilty, and, you know, you're guilty of colonialism and slavery and all that stuff. If we didn't have that, it would be a lot better. You've got this kind of weird bourgeois mentality that was created both by the Jew and the degeneracy and the luxury, all that stuff.
Yeah, and if we didn't have really women have voting.
Alimony.
No, if we didn't have women voting, you know, that's another thing the Jews did, all the feminism. And they appeal that when you give the women, the political power to go vote and have a voice in public affairs and things, and you've got this Jew media going, well, look what they do. They appeal to two things that both work on these women. They appeal to their libido and their maternal instinct. And that gets those borders thrown wide open, buddy.
Yeah, and we know what happens when women want rights in an all-white society, because you have like ancient Greece, where you have plays and, you know, stories about women who were trying to gain political power, and it always ended in disaster. And, you know, the people back then, they understood that if you were to give women what they wanted, it would end in complete insanity. So it was always common sense that you couldn't do that. But now, things are different.
Yeah, and look at the whole Arthurian myths. Every bad thing that ever happened was because of the actions of some woman. It really is. I mean, either Guinevere cheating on the king, or the king's sister Morgana deciding that she wants to rule everything, and there are several times that they were just basically just almost the end of the world because these women wouldn't act right. But and those Greek plays you're talking about, they wouldn't even let women portray the women in them.
No. Oh yeah. Well, one thing I thought was really funny was in one of those Greek plays, it ends up being communism, like straight up communism, where men have to have sex with ugly women before they can have sex with beautiful women, you know, to make sure that everyone's equal. Oh, that was really hilarious.
Well, that would put a stop to all that fat shaming, wouldn't it? Oh, speaking of which, and I don't want to get into this, but I get a bunch of free magazines in the mail, and none of them are anything I care for. I don't know why they come here, and some of them come addressed to my name, and some don't. But and I never get Sports Illustrated. But the day before yesterday, this Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue came in, and they're pushing this all shapes of women are beautiful crap. Now, don't get me wrong, most of it is like your hot bikini models, but they've got some really
land whale.
They've got some really fat women in there, and some of them they have purposely made sure and let you see the stretch marks and everything. It's pretty disgusting. But let's move on. We have some questions, a Q&A. I asked the members of the Daily Stormer BBS to give us some questions, and they did. And so I'm going to throw these out there, and we'll answer them. The Cuckslayer asked us two questions, and the first one is, question, what is the most important goal for us as nationalists to achieve in 2017? You want to take that first, Zeiger?
Well, there's different answers. I mean, if you're talking about the global level, I would say that the French election is actually very important. Now, I'm not like super into politics, which is ironic because we talk about Trump all day, but generally, I don't think politics is that important. But in this case, the French election is important because if Le Pen wins, potentially that means the breakup of the European Union. And that would be a huge win for all nationalists in Europe and the world. Because if we can get that done, well, but I'm not sure how to what extent we can influence it, but we will try. That's more for like the internet. In terms of what we can do in our countries, well, it's mostly about organizing groups locally and making sure that all nationalists have groups of buddies and close friends. We can start organizing in terms of, at the very least, putting posters around, preparing for like survival-ish stuff, and just building bonds between each other. Like if by the end of 2017, most of the people in the movement are part of a strong group of guys who can, you know, get things done, like even if it's just propaganda stuff, I mean, that will be a huge movement forward, because as the political atmosphere is changing, our capacity to do things in the real world is also increasing. We have a lot more leeway and a lot more opportunities, but these opportunities are pointless if we're not in a situation to take advantage of them. And if you're just alone on your computer, well, you're not going to have a lot of opportunities to do anything, even if golden opportunities are in front of you. So I think that's what a lot of emphasis needs to be on. With the Daily Storm, we've got the book clubs, and there's various other organizations that people can be a part of. And we're already seeing a huge increase in organization and on-the-ground activism since the election, and we need to continue in that direction, I think. What do you think, Asmador?
I agree, and I'll expand on that in a minute, but I wanted to ask Ken. Ken, what do you think is the most important goal for us as nationalists to achieve in 2017?
I'm going to echo what Zeiger had to say about in-person networking. I mean, everybody knows where I came from, so when I encountered the Daily Stormer book club people in person, I gotta tell you, like anybody with the agency to come out even just to have a meal and socialize, they're high quality. They're people worth knowing.
Yeah.
So it's very, very easy to feel like you've become isolated and disconnected because you spend your entire day being told you're alone, you're a freak, you're a loser in your basement, and then you find out there are other people that think like you. And I got to tell you that, like, once five or six people start meeting regularly, those groups expand exponentially, and that there's no feeling like it.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm going to just be an echo chamber of this. The most important thing that we need to do in 2017 is, now, of course, I'm not saying to stop what we've been doing because it's working, but we can't become static. We can keep doing the stuff that we've been doing online. You know, for the vast majority of people, that means social media. And, you know, of course, you got all the people with the podcasts and the websites and all that stuff's great. And we need to double down on that. But the most important goal for us as nationalists to achieve in 2017 is to get out from behind the keyboard, get out there in the real world, hook up with some compatriots, and do a little in real life activism, whether it's hanging up flyers or passing out pamphlets or going to counter demonstrations or attending events. And as Zeiger and Ken both mentioned, the Daily Stormer book clubs. And I'm going to take this opportunity to try to shout out there to any of my Northeast Texas comrades who may be out there. Ever since the book club started, I've been trying to get a Northeast Texas area, which that's Tyler and Longview area, book club going. And there hasn't been all that much interest. And so if you're listening to this and you're from that area, go to the Daily Stormer's BBS to the book club section and leave me a reply in the Tyler East Texas book club section. But yeah, you guys are absolutely right. It's unbelievable how it changes your attitude to meet with people who think and feel exactly as you do. When I went to A&M for Richard Spencer's event and met up with the guys from the various Texas Stormer clubs, and we after that, after the event was over, we went and hung out in Chili's and everything. That's one of the best group of guys that I have had the honor to hang out with and get to know in my life. I mean, they're just some of the best people there are. It's your fellow nationalists, and there's plenty of us, and we need to get together. That's what the Jews fear. They don't fear us. They don't fear a bunch of individuals at the end of their computers nearly as much as they fear a bunch of like-minded, strong white men. That the answer, the only thing that has the power to destroy the Jewish influence in our white nations is the strong white male. And there's plenty of us out there. We just need to get together. All right. Let me find us another question. Okay. All right. A lot of people asked about the press conference, but we already commented on that. Here's a guy that says he would like to hear our take on the Flynn situation, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
Here's somebody that says, "You mad, bro?" No, I'm not. Okay.
maybe it's Zencaster just a little bit.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the program that let us down.
That's wholly justified anger. But in general, I think most of us are actually pretty upbeat people.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, what are your thoughts on the hopefully temporary halt to the refugees? Do you think Trump will outsmart the Jews and get it reinstated?
Yes.
We kind of touched on that. But here, the main thought is, and I meant to bring this up earlier and I forgot, you know, the big headline on Drudge yesterday or day before was that I believe the number was 67%. 67% of the refugees admitted since the travel ban come from the 7 banned terrorist hotbed countries. Okay, now here's a really good question. And I'll direct this first to you, Zeiger, and then Ken after. Do you guys think the next 4 to 8 years should be a purely culture war to recruit more members to our cause?
Well, I mean, people who know my positions know that, like, if you're saying culture war, it depends what you mean. If by culture war you mean only memes on the internet, then I say no. The culture war can have a larger definition, because ultimately what will give us victory is when the normies, who will probably never be on our side just through information, like Daily Stormer can grow to be 10 times bigger, but until something else changes, people are not going to be, like, normal people are not going to be actual neo-Nazis. But there is a cultural way to push our value system, and that's through kind of a different way to go about things. And that would be getting resources and services and kind of a social atmosphere within our groups that is so appealing that it bleeds into the culture and makes it so that normal people want to join us for the community and for the benefits that we offer. For example, you start with your group that might last a year or 2 years, where you're just building a bond between brothers. You can expand that to and start doing, say, purchasing groups where you pull your money together, buy large amounts of stuff, and then maybe people will see that in your, you know, social circle and see, hey, you guys are doing something really good and useful. Can I be a part of that? And so if you have these groups, maybe you hikes every week, maybe you have parties or cultural events that people can be a part of. And if you're organized enough, people will be attracted to that just to fulfill that need that they have of community and kind of the clan aspect that they can't get in the modern world. And the ultimate question here is we have to provide things that they can't get from the government and the state and all of these, you know, cucked institutions controlled by Jews. And there's many things that we can do. But to do that, the first step, of course, is, you know, in real life organization. And we need to grow that until we have a lot to offer people. So in that sense, you could call that a culture war. But there's a kind of a greater aspect to it. And a lot of groups are doing that already. If you look at Greece, Golden Dawn, they're not just doing demonstrations on the street. They're not just getting elected to office. They're not just giving flyers. They're also, you know, doing charity events. They're helping people with their security. They have a hotline that people can call, and they'll come and help, you know, old ladies if they're feeling afraid and things like that. So they're creating a social movement that's greater than just pure information. Most people don't really care about anyway.
Right, right. Yeah, and they do things like they do real world stuff like the soup lines and stuff, you know, hungry Greek, and they make sure that it's only for Greeks. Like they, when they first started doing it, they would just put up a sign that said, this is for ethnic Greeks only, you know, to, so that the Muslim migrants wouldn't all line up to eat their food. And some court struck that down. And so the next day they came out and they put up a sign that said pork soup free to anybody. And, so, yeah, I mean, and they did great things like, you know, they really, you know, Greece is like a canary in the coal mine for, you know, the new Jewish paradigm of taking these nations down through their banking systems and you know, making them pay back loans by taking away pensions and benefits and all that the citizens have earned. And so one of the things that they were going to do to help pay all this crap to Germany was they were going to raise the tolls on their toll roads. And the day that that stuff was set up to go, there was a bunch of big burly dudes in the black Golden Dawn shirts. They had at least one for every toll collection kiosk. And they went and stood beside the toll takers and told them, open the barricades. And they just opened it up. And every single driver in Greece on those toll roads that day got it for free. And that kind of stuff's really important. We need to let these people know that we're coming at this. We're your real new alternative. That, you know, whether you want to call us fascists or national socialists or some dirty words that you come up with or whatever, that yeah, we have a different way.
That if people depend on you, if they get valuable things out of you, it doesn't matter what you're called. They don't care. If they can get soup when they're hungry or if they can get a free pass on the toll booth, they don't care that they're getting it from Nazis.
Like, that's right. And well, it shows them who the good guys are.
Yeah.
Okay. That may have. Okay. There's one more question and then we can just address it really quickly. Cause I actually brought up South Africa already, but The kids are – oh, and the person who asked that question, I want to give him a shout-out. Hang on a second. Well, I'll have to scroll up for it, so never mind. Whoever gave that question out, great question. Sorry I didn't do the shout-out to you. This comes from the Kids Are Alt-Right, is the name of this user on the BBS. He says, any thoughts about the ever-increasing racial hostilities in Pretoria, South Africa? Hundreds of whites and blacks squared off a few weeks ago. Do you think that if a race war is sparked in South Africa, that it would spread to other occupied territories in the West? And he says, edit, they, in parentheses, the Jews, still place the blame on xenophobia as whites express their desire not to become victims of genocide. Well, my answer to that is probably not. And the reason I say that is it's already a hot race war over there. It has been for quite some time. If you look at the number of people there versus the number of black on white rapes and home invasions and murders and all this other stuff, it's been a race war there for a long, long time. And it hasn't spread here in the sense that this person's asking, but this stuff does embolden the organized blacks, like the New Black Panthers and the BLM and so forth, because they do have a lot of Mandela ANC type iconography to their movement. So they're paying attention to this stuff. But you got to remember, we have a different situation here. The whites in South Africa are vastly outnumbered by blacks, and it's the other way around here.
I think it's foolish to assume that blacks would be watching the news at all.
Well, I agree, but they like I said, these activist blacks are into what's going on in South Africa. At least to the extent that they can understand it.
Right. No, American blacks are so the genetic history of your average genetic American black is so different than the tribal one just by sheer virtue of the amount of white DNA in the gene pool. You can't expect that just because they sort of look the same, they're going to behave the same in Africa as they do here. Is wider race war going to spread? I don't. Except for some very talented, very exceptional cases in the 70s, I have never really seen blacks organize at all. And really, who was organizing the Civil Rights Watch? It wasn't black people doing it. It wasn't MLK. Someone else was pulling the strings. That's what you got to watch for.
Well, yeah. Even the NAACP was not only founded by Jews, I think they went for a couple of decades without having anything but like one token black guy on their board. So,
in South Africa, in many ways, it was the same thing. Mandela had an associate. I think it was Shlomo something. Name literally Shlomo. Yeah. He was helping him, giving him funds and giving him advice. A communist.
Well, yeah, and there's the picture
everywhere.
There's the famous picture of the two of them, Mandela and that Jew. I can't think of his name. I have the picture in my on my computer, but they're standing in front of a giant communist flag, the red flag with the gold hammer and sickle. They're both holding their fists up in the, well, it was originally the communist symbol, and people in America think of it as the black power symbol, and it's Mandela and that Jew. This just total Jewish communism. It's that way everywhere. I mean, and it's to show people that Dr. Pierce was absolutely right about the mainstream media being the most powerful weapon that the Jews have. That 100%, that's what brought down the apartheid government of South Africa. It wasn't the blacks that brought it down, and it wasn't the activists on the ground that brought it down. It was international pressure from the mainstream media that caused everybody in the world to quit doing business with South Africa.
Yeah, and actually, I was right. I think it was literally Shlomo. Like, that was...
Zeiger, you there? Okay. Well, we lost Zeiger there for a minute. And this show tonight has just been plagued with gremlins. But I probably, if I have to put everything else aside and work on this all week long, we're going to have these problems ironed out by next week, surely. I'm going to make that my number one priority. But anyway, since we don't know where we left off and we were done with the questions, we're going to go right to the break now. And when we come back from the break, we're going to do the news and then we'll be done.
Stop slipping further right. Start this train. I want to be able to go outside again without feeling scared for my young skin. It might be rough, but honestly, won't someone start this train? Just wanna see the Jewish girl. One generation's length away from civil war in America. Start this train. I want to be able to go outside again without feeling scared for my young skin. It might be rough, but honestly, won't someone start this train? So scared of getting darker, I'm only good at being white. So I play the culture game and find a way to see that war will soon begin. Had a talk with Hitler's men, said help me understand. They said don't take the bait, it's not a Ford, they just start this train. Don't for a minute change the way you think. Turn that outright into the outright. Know your end, just honestly go start that fucking train.
In 16 years, the system, which has now been overthrown, has piled mistake upon mistake, illusion upon illusion, degeneracy thrown one after another. That seems only truer when we examine this culture, which we must unknot. Only very recently, when our movement showed the world a new sort of counterculture of art, of aesthetic, humor, literacy, and fiction, fast-paced, manic even, a new resolution and resistance is rising, and our cultures will come head-to-head, and one will become ascendant. If today Christians and pagans fight alongside with us to secure the freedom of our peoples, it would be us who form the relationship and not the alliances of the old system. And immediately following the election of the president of these United States, there was a quick scrambling by the so-called clergy, feeling that this rise was a representation of a threat to them. And to that charge, I can answer. In the first place, it was Christians and not globalist atheists that granted us this victory we so desperately needed. I do not merely speak of Christianity woven into our culture as deeply as the bloody stains we left to defend it, and I will never ally myself with parties that seek to destroy it. And the church, so intertwined with our collective racial persona, has been under attack, just as the people have been under attack. Many of you should wish to rescue evangelical and Catholic Christianity from these clutches, but I would ask you, where were these churches when we were under persecution for all these years? They went arm in arm with the government, seeking to nurse their own coffers from the government, a transfer of wealth to support programs to destroy us under the guise of compassionate conservatism. No, never. And at no other time was as much damage done to the church as when these last 100 years the government worked to effect social change through these so-called Christians. And I would ask you, if the policy of economics, welfare, and the importation of religious enemies that sought and still seek to destroy us was in the interest of the people, are churches that seek to enforce globalism something for which the church should answer? When I see people whose politics are their religion claim that worship has become difficult in Trump's America, should I take them at their word? No! It is seriously too late for such antics. Besides, you had 100 years to wipe us out and enforce globalism by Shepherd's Crook. You have proved your incapacity to diminish through manipulation of a faith, a thinly veiled attempt to wipe the founders of the church on this continent, the European, out. If you see a leftist complaint that the church is under duress in this Trump's America, understand, their loyalty isn't to God, but to their politics. And I am convinced that the restoration of our people will coincide with our intrinsic need for a spiritual life and not just a political one. We must start the restoration of the health of our spirit if we are to see growth and a sense of security. And recognition that there are things in this world and the next more powerful and more important than our selfish, petty lives will cure many ills that plague us as a people now. The Slavs understand this. Communism took from them their precious human dignity, and they react with a fervor that can only be matched by their faith. And we too suffer from Marxism in the West that seeks to poison our souls and separate the common man from connecting with anything more important than the state. A state that treats you as a unit of consumption with no particular interest in your well-being. Live, consume, die, repeat. And the Marxist often speaks of freedom, but we do not possess any. We want to liberate our lands from the fetters of this impossible intersectionalist mess. Not because we are terrorists, not for the lulz, and not because we intend to gag the spirit. The entirety of this restoration must be centered around the common man and wife. But it's lacking something grander. And self-obsessed, we worship ourselves, and nothing besides the material will drive us. We need something more. The flesh is willing, but the spirit is weak. I need something to believe in. But I believe in my race, and that at least is a start.
Okay, well, that was a great monologue, and it made me think of some things, because, you know, you were talking about all the various beliefs and everything. I just wanted to bring something up here. We got several intelligent guys on the show tonight, and I think it would be interesting to hear your take on this. The you know, you were talking about Christians and pagans and all the other. And when it comes to these religions that everybody has taken on as an adult, I always wonder about, you know, how LARPy is it? Are they really like atheists who are just choosing a religion or whatever? And I've talked about that before, but an interesting thing that came to mind the other day was when I was in my 20s, I read this book that it was a really popular like self-help or light philosophy type book, bestseller type when I was probably before my time. It was The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck. And I'm going to say right off the bat that most of it was pure crap. But he brought up an interesting idea in it. And he said that if you are raised in a religion, like if you're born into it, raised into it, he said that you never really are a true adherent of that religion unless at some point you cast off that religion and then as an adult came back to it. What do you think about that, Ken? You're the expert on these things.
I would say that that's 100% accurate. When I was growing up as a kid, the church that my mother took me to, the denomination was a Portlandia version of Methodist. And as it's been going on and on and on, it became less religious and more political. And even as a young man, I would say, wait a minute, why are we talking about, you know, it's very explicitly said that this, and this is an abomination before God, but you're telling me that I have to accept it and have to enjoy it? It just struck me as hypocritical. I mean, even as a young man. And there was a lot of resentments that I had towards the church because the broken people that claim to follow it, but they do it because it's a way to accentuate their political beliefs instead of something they actually believe. It's virtue signaling. And it made me sick. But eventually I had to decide to myself, it's still there. It's still a good philosophy. It is still basically the foundation of European history for the last 2000 years. Why am I pissing this away?
Yeah.
And I will tell you that I went in and it's pure happenstance because when I was a kid, the Catholic Church sponsored my Boy Scout troop. And I thought, well, I'll just go talk to them. And the lecture that I got from them was not like full of fire and brimstone and your average like tent revival stuff. It was straight up, we're not surprised. We are not surprised. So many people that come to our church as adults, their only experience with the church was the damaged, politicized version of it where you couldn't attach any meaning to it. And it was just an opportunity to show off fancy clothes on Sunday. And it happens all the time. It's apparently they're growing by leaps and bounds because people are finally, I don't know, maybe it's Trump's America or whatever. But they're finally comfortable with like, okay, maybe Christian, maybe the church is going to be the way that it reads in the Bible and has been for the past 2000 years. And I can actually feel comfortable there again.
Yeah. Well, one of the first things I noticed was, yeah, I was raised in the Baptist church. And when I was a very small boy, at least in these small town churches that I went to with the old preachers, they didn't have all this pause that they started getting when I got into my teens, which oddly enough happened about the same time the Jews for Jesus started coming around. But they used to be completely against it. They were totally fundamentalist. And by that, I mean, if it said something in the Bible, that's what they said you're supposed to do. And so they didn't allow people to just divorce for no reason. And they didn't even things like where it said a woman is to be silent in church. They lived by that. They didn't allow female preachers. And there certainly was. I mean, people would have been aghast at the thought of not just allowing openly gay people to be members of the church, but to have them as pastors and deacons and such. And the church, I think, lost a lot of its membership when it lost its moral authority, and it gave up its moral authority. And it did that because they just wanted some way to get asses in the pews as quick as possible. And when they would start getting pushback on these things, if they resisted the social pressure, then one day something came along where it would make the leaders' own lives easier. Like this, the preacher of the last church that I went to before I decided that when I was a teenager, before I decided that the Baptist church was completely corrupt and I wanted nothing to do with it. His behavior was a lot to do with it. He had always been one of these really staunch guys. And if a couple of church members got divorced, he would refuse to remarry either one of them because, you know, in the Bible, in the gospel, it says that that's adultery to divorce your wife and then marry another one is adultery. Mm-hmm. And, then guess what? His wife divorced him. And guess what he did? Got remarried.
Oh,
he did remarry. And all of a sudden he was all modern and liberal. And, you know, it was just the ultimate hypocrisy. And fortunate that I saw it, because if I hadn't, who knows, I might be one of these. I mean, I doubt it, but I might be one of these Israel first or evangelicals now.
I think that might be a possibility. And the woman that I was talking with, I might as well just spell it out. It's Catholic. That's the route that I'm kind of heading down. She had told me that in the 60s, there was this big spiritual panic because, you know, the times they are changing and nobody was really quite sure why they were doing what they did in church. That was just what you did because that was the rule. There was no understanding. There was no belief behind it. There was no reason why. And so the church's solution was, well, people are dissatisfied. Oh, the times they are changing. Let's become more liberal, or let's do, you know, social justice. And even before that, think about the 50s. I mean, the blacks always like to brag that, you know, civil rights came out of the churches. Well, how do you think that got started?
Well, out of the black churches, you could say that a lot, but as far as, but I know the narrative you're talking about, and that comes from the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
But no,
it's 100% accurate there. And all this stuff about, like, everybody in the alt-right wants to whine about, oh, the church is paused, it's paused, it's paused. Well, dude, education is paused. Media is paused. Why? Okay, that doesn't mean that the message is bad. It means it's been corrupted by foreign influence.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the people who constantly go on and on about that, they're pagans. And by pagan, I mean, like, you know, they're Odinists or Asatru or whatever you want to call it. And hey, more power to them if they're really into that. But the thing is, the vast majority of them have just chosen to identify as that because they feel that the Christian church is paused. But so is this paganism. There are far more people who are members of these hippie type Asatru groups, or I guess a more accurate way to describe it would be these Renaissance fair type Asatru groups. And like I don't know what you'd call them, the shaman or whatever who runs the ceremonies is oftentimes like some obese black dude or whatever swinging around Thor's hammer. And the biggest Asatru organization out there is a big multicultural pause hole of an organization. So, yeah, everything's paused. I mean, it's like saying I hate music because music today is paused. Well, it wasn't always, you know, and you're throwing out a whole bunch of babies with this one tub of bad bathwater. If to say that, I mean, I don't think you would consider like the Crusaders to have been a bunch of paused anti-whites being run by the Jews. They were anything but.
Yeah.
No, well, the church, well, not just the church, but religion in general used to be a social institution based on spiritual values, on a valuing of the truth, and a valuing on basically putting principles above material convenience. And the entire modern world is about the exact opposite. It's about putting comfort and safety and material benefit and wealth above everything, above principles, above the truth, above, you know, just the future, above all intangible things. And when you go in that direction, of course, you're going to stop having family values, because family values are about valuing the future, saying, you know, I'm going to sacrifice my own welfare today so that future generations can, you know, live better. And all of these spiritual values are declining, and the church has declined with it. So to answer your question about, you know, is it normal that people leave the church and then rejoin it, and that's the only way to be really spiritual? Well, in the modern world especially, yes, because people by default are not spiritual. They're very, very shallow materialists. That's what society promotes, and that's what churches promote, that people will leave the church and then join it back again. It's because they've gotten older, they've learned from experience that this paused reality, this paused life of pure consumerism doesn't satisfy them, and it doesn't fulfill the need that they have for community and like a spiritual need to have meaning in their lives. And once they're in that state, then they're ready to learn the deeper message of religion and find what's fulfilling in that. But if they're just learning religion as a child, as just some weird social custom, no, it can never be sincere. It's meaningless.
Yeah. Well, you know what the solution to all of this is the Church of Keck. When we get the Church of Keck going, then there'll be a place for all these people who feel disaffected by all the religions that are out there, and they can come, and there will be no degeneracy, no consumerism, and none of that. But yeah, the as far as what you said is absolutely correct. It was always a social institution based on spiritual principles, and it was a great thing. A great thing when it was run that way. And it's a pity that we've lost it. But, you know, the more I watch the pendulum start swinging back right, the more I realize that nothing is ever really truly lost so long as some of us are left. It just has to be reformulated for the new era. And I think we're going to see that. You know, you've got so many people that like are leaving Protestant churches to join Catholic churches and Orthodox churches. And, you know, people are on a journey, and as long as they're being honest with themselves and all that, as they go on this journey, then it's a good thing, I think. And I agree wholeheartedly. My final point about Ken's monologue, I agree wholeheartedly that whatever, faith that you find yourself, or lack thereof, that you find yourself involved with right now, as long as you are a pro-white, a nationalist, whatever you want to call it, we need to put aside the sniping and arguing with each other over religion, and let's secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And once we've done that, then we can start arguing about these things again. And with that, Ken, you got you ready for that news music? We'll get Carolus on here and do the news.
Hey, guys. I'm Carolus Rex. This is this week's crypto news. In an article which has since been deleted, the local.se reported this Monday that in the event of a collapse, Sweden would only have enough food to last a week. In this regard, Sweden's status is one of the worst in the EU. The report points out that Sweden is largely dependent on imports for its food supply, in spite of having hundreds of thousands of square kilometers of farmable land. The majority of Sweden's farmland is unused because restrictive environmental regulations generally make it significantly cheaper to import food than grow it domestically. Sweden had previously maintained great inventory of emergency supplies, but they were deemed unnecessary after the end of the Cold War. I found that story relevant because I've been thinking about this whole idea of what would happen if the state of Sweden just collapsed under the weight of all the kebabs that they're giving Gibbs to. And I'm like, well, they would last about a week before Rahoa starts.
Well, the white people would last about a week. The kebabs and the Somalians would have all those to eat. But yeah, I mean, this is the left pulls this crap in every nation that they're in. I mean, you know, like Trump just signed the order to get rid of a bunch of the regulations that were holding us back on being energy independent. And I'm pretty certain that in upcoming weeks and months, we're going to see him repealing tons and tons of USDA and FDA regulations, as well as, you know, environmental regulations that make it hard for family farms to proliferate here in the United States like they always have. It's everywhere. We're just better off than most Western countries in that, you know, the U.S. has been more resistant on along those lines than others. But, you know, we are pretty much slaves to big agriculture right now. But yeah, I mean, when you start putting all these regulations on that make it just an onerous to try to have a family farm or, you know, raise some cattle or whatever it is, you're basically saying that some pie in the sky idea that you have about environmentalism trumps eating is more important than people getting to eat.
Yeah. It's crazy because the defining feature of the left is a complete disconnection from reality. Like these are ideas that nobody who has worked on a farm or who lives in the countryside could have. But these are attitudes that spring out from people who've lived in cities all their life and who've never had to, of course, farm their own food or kill animals that they would eat or, you know, get eggs from themselves. They probably don't even know where meat comes from. I mean, so to them, food is stuff you get from a grocery store. So it's like, well, what's the problem about, you know, not having reserves? We always have the grocery store, right? I mean, it's
yeah,
a complete disconnection from the basic realities of life about, you know, killing animals, you know, tending to the land, the importance of the soil. They're not really environmentalists because they don't understand what the relationship between the environment and human beings is. They think just technology.
Right. And if they did, they would understand that not only do these regulations make it way more likely for some, you know, to set up some type of famine, but that they're also counterproductive for the environment because individual family farmers have always been the absolute best stewards of the land. It's in their, you know, these family farms have always transferred from father to son to grandson and so on. And, you know, their lives are wrapped up in that. And not only that, you know, they feel ownership of that land. They're not going to do anything to hurt it. And when you set up all these onerous regulations that make you have to jump through so many bureaucratic hoops and hire so many teams of lawyers and lobbyists and all that, the only people who can afford to produce food on a scale that can actually feed you are the giant outfits like ConAgra who make Frankenfood and who don't give two shits about the environment. I mean, you want to see an environmental hazard, go to one of these big corporate feedlots and look how they treat those animals and look at the environmental waste. And another thing is the effect that it has on your physical health. I mean, now, like I was over at somebody's house and they had like flavored coffees and stuff. And I pick it up and I look at the ingredients and I was just looking to see if it was quality coffee in there. And it's the first time I've ever seen this one. Half of their coffees that they had said made with genetic engineering. I mean, we don't want this stuff. We don't need this stuff. What we need is fresh, wholesome food, either grown from the ground or livestock that is raised in a field and slaughtered in a humane manner so that we can have healthy bodies and healthy minds and a healthy environment. And all this regulation, it's just the opposite. But yeah, as far as what's going on with the Swedes, the Swedes, I think, and as the Germans And I don't mean this in this like every single individual, but just as a group, and especially as their government goes, these are as close to a lost people, the Swedes. I mean, I often wonder if there is any saving them as a group, yeah, or if they're just lost.
It's a good question. But one thing's for sure, I mean, we wouldn't be having all these agricultural problems if we didn't have to feed the entire third world, because there is practically not even a single third world country that has food surplus. So we're feeding all these people, and we're destroying our own soil and our own lands to do it.
Yeah, and the longer we feed them, the more of them we have to feed.
Yeah, it's a never-ending cycle that can only end in the destruction of all the agricultural lands on Earth.
Yeah.
Well, I've never heard an environmentalist talk about that.
I would like to say on the Sweden front, I mean, seriously, sometime read the history of the Weimar Republic. Sweden is hurt and they're broken, but they're not out.
Well, yeah, but the difference between, in my opinion, the difference between Sweden and the Germans who lived during the Weimar Republic is, yeah, the Germans who lived during the Weimar Republic had been broken down and were hopeless of things improving until the National Socialists came along. But they didn't like what was going on. I think the majority of Swedes have been brainwashed into thinking that what they're doing is the right thing to do.
Sad but true.
Well, that's going to change when they start starving. So
yeah, but the thing is it too late then?
I guess we're going to have to find out. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I am done as an American rescuing Europe from itself. You have the means to do it. Figure it out.
Yeah. And you know, the Swedish thing is kind of personal to me because as many of the listeners know, I have a stepmother who she's a citizen, an American citizen now, but she was a Swedish national. She came over here in the 70s to go to college and she stayed here as an executive with a big corporation. And her family is from a town way up north of the Arctic Circle. And now they're spreading, they're pushing those migrants all the way up there now. You know, these tiny, tiny little towns where basically everybody's a cousin and the sun doesn't shine for half the year. I mean, there is no escaping it.
They must have to push pretty hard because, I mean, come on, they're flowing in for easy gibs. If we didn't make it easy for the gibs, then they wouldn't be flowing in. So,
well, yeah, but you got to understand, Sweden is a huge country. And, like, Stockholm is way south of where I'm talking about. Where I'm talking about is up, like, by where the Laplanders live and stuff. It's basically Santa Claus land. And the Swedish government is making sure that none of these little villages don't get enriched. But yeah, I mean, you know, and I can see why it was so easy to do this to the Swedes, but you know, from knowing a few of them from, you know, being my family marrying into them, these people cannot stomach conflict or rudeness. I mean, it's almost like you hit them to bring up something like, you know, maybe there's too many niggers here. Oh God, maybe so, but like we have to talk about it. You know, it's so rude, and it's just a totally different thing from what people who are descended from the Western Europeans who founded the countries in the, you know, the French and the English and such, who founded America and Canada and Australia and all like that. And fortunately, we still have some of that racist spunk, I guess you'd call it, that we've always had. But the Swedes are just a changed people. They have been for quite some time.
You know what it reminds me of a little bit is that Matthew Broderick movie, War Games, where the crazed scientist is sitting in his cabin in the middle of the woods, and he's like, yeah, they're pretty much going to destroy themselves. Maybe nature will start over. Maybe this time with the bees, right? And I'm thinking maybe there are some European races that just lack the will to live and they've given into complacency and pacifism, and maybe it's time to just let them go. But everybody counter signals me on that, so I don't bring it up too
well,
much.
Well, as long as there's a chance of saving them, it's definitely worth the effort. But the problem is that when it comes to other cultures, and you know, being a Swede is a culture of its own, and when it comes to other cultures, other nations, or whatever, it's pretty much the same as one person and another person. You know, you can't save anybody. Like, if you're someone that you really care about is a drug addict, it doesn't matter what you do, you can't save that person. They have to save themselves. And once they're ready to save themselves, then sure, you can help them. But it ultimately is up to the person who has the problem to solve it for themselves, because, you know, nobody's forcing the Swedes to wallow in this self-hate. I mean, I know, yeah, there are people tricking them into it, but and there are a lot of good Swedes who are working to overcome this. I mean, they've got like Nordfront and several other really good nationalist organizations over there, and they've got one or two fairly decent center right type political parties and all. So maybe there's some hope, but yeah, it's really blackpilling to even bring the Swedes up, because I mean the whole Captain Sweden thing really, that meme really is true. All right, Carolus, you want to go to the next story?
From the Daily Mirror in the UK, Nigel Farage piled pressure on his successor, Paul Nuttall, over the stroke by-election today as he made a brazen bid to steer his party's future direction. UKIP leader Mr. Nuttall faces a tough fight to beat Labour in next week's poll after his campaign was dogged by controversy. Now, Mr. Farage has warned the by-election is fundamental for UKIP's future and warned Labour's ground campaign would be tough to fight. Hurling into Mr. Nuttall's brief, he also said UKIP must reject any bid to go mainstream. Warning, UKIP is a radical party or it is nothing. Ken, play the Nigel Farage clip.
There is, with this big attitudinal change that is taking place across the West, there is, I think, a very important message for UKIP. A message that UKIP needs to think about. A message that UKIP needs to act upon. This party went from nothing to being the first party to win a national election, as we did in 2014. The first party since 1906 to win a national election, to force a referendum and to play a very important part in that campaign. This party succeeded because we were prepared to think the unthinkable. This party succeeded because we were prepared to speak the unspeakable. This party succeeded because we had guts, we had passion, we were brave, and we were unafraid of criticism. That's why we succeeded. But now I sense that there are too many people in UKIP whose jobs and positions have come directly as a result of that bold strategy, who are now urging UKIP to become mainstream. Now, I understand this. It's nice to be popular. It's good to get invited to all the right social set parties in London. And I guess it is easier in life to be thought of as being nice rather than one of those unpleasant populists. But this attitude, folks, is not UKIP. UKIP is a radical party or it is nothing.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, you know, the only people who find populists unpleasant are the ones who don't want the will of the people done. I mean, that's what populism is. I mean, that's the dictionary definition. You do what the people want. And as we discussed with Andrew Anglin, this attack on populism by the international Jewish media they're basically telling the whole world that if you don't put the Jewish interest first, you're evil, that you should not put your own interest first.
No, it was a great speech. The best speech I've heard Nigel Farage ever say. If he was speaking like that, well, he was president of UKIP. I think it would have been even better. But yeah, I mean, definitely, UKIP, like the entire world is in a populist uprising, so to speak. There's a wave that is very palpable because of Donald Trump and because of various other parties that are rising. And this is definitely not the time to be moderating the message. This is the time to be becoming more radical, not less. I mean, this is obvious. And really, Nigel Farage hit the nail on the head with his examples. He said, well, it would be nice to be invited to all the nice parties and to be thought of as a good person, because he's really characterizing that this drive towards being mainstream is a character flaw. It's because people have a flawed character. They're weak, they're soft, they want material benefits, and this is the reason they're doing it. They're not doing it to win, they're not doing it because they think those ideas are better. It's purely a egotistical drive. And by framing it this way, it's making it very clear and very embarrassing for those people. And this is what you have to do. You have to humiliate and embarrass people who are peddling lies for their own personal benefit. So I think it's an admirable speech, and it could have been done in even like a national socialist context, a Nazi context, and would have been a perfect speech either way.
Yeah, and we see this over and over throughout every country, and in a lot of ways throughout history. You have some type of a movement that has a lot of building popularity, that has kind of a revolutionary flavor to it. And UKIP certainly, especially before the whole Brexit thing, even though, you know, a lot of people in the alt-right want to call them cucks and say, well, they're not ethno-nationalists and all that, they were still an extremely revolutionary party because they wanted to and succeeded in getting Britain out of the European Union, which was a huge thing that nobody thought would ever get done. And you always have these hangers-on who will, among the political class, who will latch on to these movements and ride that popular wave into office and then immediately go back on everything they said to be mainstream. And we saw that in the last midterm elections that we had for Congress. I mean, these people all got in there saying that they weren't going to fund Obamacare, that they weren't going to fund his amnesty and all that, you know, all that huge Republican victory they had where they took back the House and Senate and all that. And they got in there, and the first thing they did was fund all those things. And unfortunately, at the time, there was no American Nigel Farage to counter signal against that, and that's why we got Trump. So I think, you know, if these people are paying close attention and they want to maintain this power and they want to get invited to all the best cocktail parties and everything in the future after another election or two, they had better stick to these principles that got them elected.
Do you want Trumps? Because that's how you get Trumps. Just keep thwarting the will of the people.
We don't think about it. The speech is like a modified version of a Hitler speech. Hitler's got a speech where he says, you know, there was a time when it was difficult to be a national socialist. And he's making a reference to like all the people in the party now who are just like cozy because they're in power and all of that stuff. But he said, you know, back in the day, you had to have courage and drive to be a national socialist because everyone was against us. And, you know, that's what it means. You have to fight. And you know, I think there's a parallel there.
Oh, he's right. Yeah,
absolutely.
In 1933, I think, his address to the Party Congress. I don't remember the year specifically, but it's an awesome speech where he's kind of talking past the rest of them. And he just says, yeah, things look pretty good now, but all of you old fighters, and that's where I got the term from, is when Hitler refers to all the brown shirts and the party members that were like, you know, member number 20. It used to be a hell of a lot harder, and we're really only here because of you.
Yeah. Well, you know, when Hitler first joined the National Socialist Party and went to Berlin. When he got to Berlin, there were something like 11 members of the NSDAP and over 100,000 card-carrying members of the Socialist Party there in Berlin. And in less than a decade, they had completely taken over. So, and you know, not to the extent that they did, at least not yet. You know, we don't experience these things, but I totally see what he's talking about, because I see our movement as rising and that it will eventually reassert itself, you know, as nationalism and real blood and soil nationalism. I think at some point in the future is going to hold political hegemony over, if not all, most of our countries again. You know, of course, if it doesn't, they're not going to be our countries anymore. But yeah, I can definitely say it's going to be a whole different experience for the people who, once the thing, you know, once we start getting candidates elected and all that, it's going to be a whole different experience for people who go and join this popular rising movement than it is for those of us who are out here now with our names and our faces out there, you know, like being the lonely voice crying out in the wilderness about this stuff. And to be honest with you, I'm kind of proud to be here already. But all right, Carolus, one more story and then we'll wrap this show up.
From the AP in Madison, Wisconsin. Wednesday, the student government at the University of Wisconsin-Madison said black students should be afforded free tuition and housing because blacks were legally barred from education during slavery and university remains out of reach for black students today. The Associated Students of Madison said in a resolution that students from suburban high schools are overrepresented. The group said consideration of ACT and SAT scores in applications restricts opportunities for the poor and thus upholds white supremacy. The resolution's author, ASM Student Council Rep. Tyreek Mack, said in a statement, "The university's rhetoric suggests that it is committed to diversity and inclusion, so this legislation compels the university to move towards action, which is imperative. If no one challenges the university's empty promises, then racial composition will remain stagnant. The resolution demands free access to the university for all black people, including former inmates. That means free tuition, free housing, and no fees," Max said. "That would save a black resident undergraduate student about $20,000 a year." The resolution goes on to call for the university to use 10% of donations to bolster financial aid and study the feasibility of test-optional and geographically weighted admission. The language mirrors demands that the Black Liberation Collective, a national network of black youth focused on higher education, has made to nearly 90 campuses across the country. Race relations have been a contentious issue at Wisconsin's flagship campus for months. Last spring, pictures of swastikas and Adolf Hitler were posted on a Jewish student's door. Someone hurled racial slurs and spat at a black student in a dorm, and police arrested a black student during class for spray painting anti-racist messages on campus buildings. Minority students spent the semester pressuring administrators for change. Last month, a student who was imprisoned for burning down two black churches tried to start a white supremacist group on campus. He abandoned his efforts following intense backlash, but the student government criticized blank for saying he had legal right to express his views.
Okay, so 2 points on that. One, you want to give up on standards entirely. That's fine. It's not like your degree was worth a damn anyway. And two, how many of these so-called hate attacks actually happened?
Oh, probably none.
Have you guys been to Madison, Wisconsin? I have. There's no blacks there. They could admit every – it's a very comfortable position to take in Madison, Wisconsin, when there's only like six black guys in the entire thing.
Well, that's hard to say, though, because the way these universities have changed so much over the last few years. When I went to A&M last December, The town itself, Bryan and College Station, the little metro area around College Station, still looked like it always had. I mean, because all my older cousins and everything went to A&M, and I used to go up there now and then during the summer. And, you know, it was just white people everywhere. And, boy, the minute you got close to that campus, it was like you were in Babylon. It was just covered up in dindos. They recruit them from everywhere, and they pay them. But my point I want to make about this is, yeah, keep demanding more shit, black people, because the more of it you do, the more people realize what everybody on this show already knows. And that is, if there is one thing that the laws of physics say can never be filled, it's an outstretched black hand. It doesn't matter how much Gibbs you put in it. That sumbitch is always empty. It's got to have more. And my other point is, instead of giving you all this aid and these college degrees, how about we just give all of you about $2 or $3 million apiece to move to Africa, where you won't have all this white supremacy holding you down, and you can create the black We Was Kangs utopia with flying space pyramids and all that good shit, and you don't have to worry about evil whitey anymore.
Oh, but even that's not enough, Asmodor. Last week I wrote an article about you know, a black student who visited Africa, and he got so sad because the white supremacists were already in Africa, and they, you know, they called him a nigger.
Oh, so,
I think yeah. Even when you go to Africa, like the white supremacists will travel around and follow them just to hurt their feelings. So unfortunately, yeah. There's no easy answer.
Yeah, well, we have to send them someplace that it's all black and that it hasn't had too much Western aid, so that they can just be themselves with no white people, you know, some type of a paradise like Liberia that's run by cannibal warlords with names like General Butt Naked. And they can express.
Now you're talking.
Oh, yeah, and they can express their blackness with zero interference or influence from white people or Western culture or any of that. And then 100 years from now, we can go check on their progress, and when they beg us to let them back in, we can tell them, no, you made a deal, you're going to stick to it.
Well, don't you think that by the time we go back and check on them, they're already going to be, like, space? They'll have spaceships and, like, orbital stations, stuff like that. I think we're going to be very impressed when we finally go back.
Well, yeah. I mean, they do have one space program over there. But to be honest with you, when I look into my crystal ball and I contemplate what if we got all the blacks together and put them in one place, I figure that if we went back in 100 years, their numbers would have dwindled to like 2 or 3% of what they are now, and they would have devolved into some form of ancient primate.
Probably. They look awfully a lot like a Sasquatch, I think. Sorry.
Oh, no.
No. Oh, the bands.
Sasquatches have white skin and large brains. They're not remotely related to niggers. Anyway. All right. You got me. I have noticed that whenever somebody gets upset at my bants online, they suddenly don't recognize that that's a Sasquatch, and they refer to my avatar as an ape, which is so racist. but anyway,
speciesism.
Well, you know, the Sasquatch is like, it has a common ancestor, but it evolved separately, I think. That's my theory. It's all a bunch of cryptozoology, which means it's basically bullshit. So, anyway, that's all we got tonight subject-wise. Before we go, Zyger, I want you to tell us a little bit about Hammercast, what you do on Hammercast, and if you know already, tell us what's on your upcoming episode.
Right, I don't know exactly what's going to be on the upcoming episode. I only have about half of it recorded, but the Hammercast is a I don't like to say educational because when you say educational, nobody listens to it. But I try to make it entertaining. But the purpose of it is to help people get better at arguing, basically. So my goal is to make sure that people feel comfortable expressing their views in public with their friends, their family, their coworkers, you know, wherever, all social situations. And to do that, in the earlier episode, I just gave lists of arguments and rebuttals so that people can memorize them. But now, the later episodes, I'm doing live debates with guests and with regular contributors so that people can hear what good practice in these kinds of debates is. And after we do the debates, we do a breakdown, we analyze what we did right, what we did wrong. And depending on the guests, I often do special scenarios. So when you were on, Asmodor, we did the how to deal with the Antifa. So you were like the nationalist and I was an Antifa. And so you blasted me into oblivion. And it was a good demonstration for people to see, like, how do you deal with Antifa if you're at a protest? Other situations, yeah, is going to be with family or with TV interviews or radio interviews. It's all very helpful for people because there's just not enough of that kind of education and training done. And I think it's very important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to say that despite it being educational, it actually is a very, very entertaining show. And with guests like myself, and Nat Dainlaw, you've had on recently, everybody loves Natty. And that guy always delivers the goods. He's entertaining and smart as hell. And you had, I believe last week you had Matt Heimbach, right?
Yeah.
How can it? On. Oh, yeah, yeah. I heard that one too. You had Weave. And sometimes you'll like pick out some really interesting people, say from somewhere like the Daily Stormer BBS or whatever, that people may not have heard of, but who turn out to be great guests with a lot of good input. And I don't just recommend shows this strongly, lightly. And I recommend Hammercast as much as I could possibly recommend it. Go listen to Hammercast. If you check out the Asmodor channel on SoundCloud, I always repost them, so you can find them there and subscribe to Hammercast. We'll put a link to Hammercast in this post as well. And it's just an awesome show, and it's definitely is filling a niche that needs to be filled. You're doing a great job with that. Just keep doing it.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, and thanks for coming on. Yeah, and thanks for coming on with us tonight. And this has been such a rough night on technical issues and everything, and it's the second week in a row it's been like that I need to put out an extra thanks to the two best producers in the alt-right, and that's my producer, Ken, and my executive producer, Carolus Rex, who have both been working like field Negroes to keep this, try to patch this thing together and get something out there that everybody can listen to and enjoy. So I guess that's it for the Crypto Report, and we'll be back next Saturday. Everybody have a great week, and hail victory.